You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about an effort to protect and restore wild rice in Wisconsin, one that's bringing the University of Wisconsin and the state's tribes together. Right now, it's time for our weekly Wisconsin News Roundup, checking in with reporters around the state about the stories they've been covering. First, the State Fair is underway in Milwaukee, and this year, the State Department of Natural Resources is expanding its popular exhibit after 2 years of cutbacks. Paul Smith is the outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Judith. Good afternoon.
The DNR's Exploratory Park exhibit is back this year after being heavily cut back in the last couple of years. Can you talk about what changed in 2017?
Yes, in 2017, the Department of Natural Resources made a decision to drastically reduce their exhibit at the Wisconsin State Fair. The department had a 70-year history, so dating to 1947, quite a large exhibit at the fair. And in 2017, they reduced it by what employees estimated was 98%. So they cut many of their popular features, and this included Smokey Bear Schoolhouse, which generations of fairgoers visited and learned about wildfire prevention. And it also cut the big fish aquariums that the DNR takes to many of their exhibits. That was a very popular feature, as well as many programs. Wildlife was not represented after the 2017 cut, and many other programs. It maintained a very small presence for state parks and endangered resources. So that move, the justification was really never given by the department, but obviously it would have reduced costs for the department to exhibit.
And were people reacting to the fact that it was such a reduced presence? Did people notice that they weren't there?
Yeah, it was I would characterize it as a huge disappointment to fairgoers. I visited the fair that year, and a DNR employee was tasked with taking comments from people. She had a notebook, and people could write comments, or she'd write them for them. And I was able to read a few pages. There wasn't a single positive review of the change. So this had been a very popular exhibit. It's by the department's estimation, they had 300,000 visitors to the fair pre-2017. And for many people, that fair visit represented the only contact they would have with a DNR employee each year. You know, the department touches each of our lives, but not always very visibly. They oversee clean air and clean water and those type of things that positively affect our lives. But it's not often that a Wisconsin citizen can actually speak face-to-face to a DNR employee, and the fair certainly provided that opportunity.
So here we are 2 years later, and the exhibit is back in full force. What does it include this year?
Well, last year, after great public outcry, the department did bring back Smokey's Schoolhouse and some of the fish displays. So it did increase slightly last year. Now, this year, it has ramped up significantly more, and they're going to fill the entire what's called the North Building at the fair. So it will bring back representation from all DNR programs, and it'll include many more employees. So it's also got hands-on displays that are tied to Governor Evers' declaration that 2019 be the year of clean drinking water. So there's a theme, a drinking water theme or a water theme that runs through each of the displays. And many of them are geared to kids so they can actually get their hands wet and touch stuff and interact with water and learn about it.
Well, Paul, thanks so much for giving us the details.
Thank you.
Paul Smith is the outdoors editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with us about the DNR's Exploratory Park exhibit at the State Fair, which runs through August 11th. Now we head north to Oneida County, where investigators are recommending charges against a forestry official for his alleged misuse of public resources. Rob Menser is the rural communities reporter for WPR News based in Wausau. Rob, thanks for being here.
Why, thank you.
This starts with a 39-acre piece of land that the Oneida County Forestry Director purchased earlier this year. Can you tell us how he acquired this property?
So the property was owned by a group of three people, some of whom lived – none are from Wisconsin. They lived in different parts of the state. And Billigan acquired first once a stake in the land and then the second stake, and then eventually was, according to the sheriff's investigation, used pressure and intimidation to get the third landowner to sell to him.
And so that was one part of this, but then Billigan had the land and the misuse of county resources became an issue. What happened there?
Well, so what started this as an investigation in the first place was in April, Billigan used county resources, a county backhoe, and some county labor, as well as a work crew from the McNaughton Correctional Facility, a state prison that's in Oneida County, to clear land on his that he privately owned. There's a logging road that goes into this property, and he was in the process of working to obtain an easement from the town there to make it a town road. But that had not happened, and he, as forestry director of Oneida County, called in this work crew as well as this county backhoe to work on this land, and that triggered the complaint that he's using public resources for his private good.
I have to say that doesn't seem very discreet. I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of paperwork to have prison labor coming out of the facility and working somewhere. A big piece of machinery is also fairly noticeable. Was there any sense that he was trying to hide this?
You know, the use of these prison work crews is routine up there for doing forestry work. They're paid $1 an hour. And this is not – it is not unusual for the county forestry director to direct them to various, you know, county forest lands. That's like a thing that Oneida County and other counties do. You know, in this case, Billigan has defenders. I talked to a county board member who's of the view that he did nothing wrong here. And in this case, this was a road that was going to become, in his way of thinking, going to become a town road, and so it was a legitimate use of this labor. There's a little evidence that he concealed. For instance, the Oneida County Corporation Counsel, the lawyer for the county there, there were documents in the sheriff's investigation that said that he believed that Billigan had intentionally withheld key information about this decision before he approved it.
So basically, what you're saying is that him signing out this work crew or this piece of equipment would not raise eyebrows unless people realized where it was being used.
Exactly so. Yep, exactly so.
So the sheriff's office is recommending criminal charges. Who makes the final decision on whether those will be filed or not?
Right. And it is important to say no charges have been filed against Billigan. He's been on paid leave for several months while this investigation is going on. The sheriff recommended charges, but the Oneida County District Attorney recused himself. He's in the same building. You know, he's a colleague with this department director. And so it is in the hands of the Lincoln County District Attorney. Lincoln County District Attorney has not filed charges and declined to comment to me on whether charges will be forthcoming anytime soon.
And has Billigan himself made any comment?
Billigan has not. This has been reported by several outlets. I tried and continue to try to reach him, and I was not able to. He hasn't said anything, but I suppose if you know, he may want to wait and see what the legal system decides as well.
Well, Rob, before we let you go, you wrote a little bit this week about the Lumberjack World Championships that are happening this week in Hayward. You were not able to make it up there, but is that on your wish list for getting up there?
Boy, it is now. It sounds like quite a trip. This is the 60th year of these. It's the executive director converted me. He's talking about the pole climb and the log rolling events. It sounds sounds great.
We got to ask you, Rob, which event do you think you'd excel at?
To me, I'm very outdoorsy. I feel like I could log roll with the best of them.
Oh, you know,
I'm not very outdoorsy. This is listeners don't know this. No,
we actually interviewed a champion high school Wisconsin log roller about a year or two ago. So you know, maybe I should send you that link and you can start working on your technique.
It's perfect for me because it does not actually require strength as such. It's just balance. I can work. You know,
balance. Yeah. Just. Yeah. Standing up on a moving
block.
How hard can it be? Well, Rob, thanks as always for joining us.
Thank you.
Rob Menser is the Rural Communities Reporter for WPR based in Wausau. He was with us to wrap up our weekly check-in on news stories from around the state. We also talked with Paul Smith of the Journal Sentinel about the DNR bringing its popular exhibit back to the state fair. Coming up, we'll hear from a UW graduate student about her research aimed at protecting and restoring wild rice in Wisconsin. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, after incidents of mass violence, some research has shown that intense national media coverage can inspire others to commit similar acts. We'll talk with an expert on mass shootings about why the media should be changing its coverage. First, a new research project led by a UW graduate student looks to bring together tribal and university researchers on the issue of wild rice protection and restoration. Sarah Dance is a second-year PhD student who studies environmental chemistry and technology in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. She's a member of the Lumbee Tribe of North Carolina and recently received a Baldwin, Wisconsin Idea Grant to support her work. She recently spoke with Ideas Network producer Chris Molina about the project.
So can you start by talking about the importance of wild rice to the tribes that settled here in the Midwest so many years ago?
Yeah, so wild rice, or Manoman in Ojibwe, is an incredibly important cultural and ecological resource in the Great Lakes region. For many of the tribes, it's considered to be a sacred gift from the Creator. For the Menominee particularly, their name actually means the wild rice people. And it's not just the Ojibwe and Menominee. There are a lot of other nomadic tribes or other tribes in the region that find it really important. It's a really important income source. Many of the tribes actually harvest the rice and sell it themselves. And as far as the ecological significance, it's actually our only emergent aquatic grass that's native to the region. So it has a really important niche in the environment.
So what can you tell us about the current state of wild rice in Wisconsin, as well as the conditions needed to grow it?
Yeah, absolutely. So over the past 100 years, we've seen a 32% decline in watersheds across Minnesota and Wisconsin, and that's mostly been located in the southern portion of Wisconsin. So we've seen dramatic declines over the past 100 years, and I've heard recently from natural resource managers in the region that we've seen even more significant declines in the last few years. So it's kind of happening at this really rapid pace. The conditions that we need, it needs to be at a certain water level. If the water level goes too high or too low, then the rice won't be able to survive. Some other conditions, it needs relatively low levels of sulfate in the overlying water in order to grow properly. It needs the right amount of nutrients without having to compete with native or invasive species that may do better under elevated nutrient concentrations. And beyond that, yeah, it also needs enough time for the overlying water to be frozen above the seeds. So in a warming climate, it is struggling in southern Wisconsin.
You mentioned a warming climate. Is climate change considered to be one of the reasons that we've seen such a decline? Or are there other factors that are playing in as well?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Climate change is one of the major contributors to the decline of wild rice. And to say that, though, it not to just put it into a black box. It is the elevated temperatures, the increased severity and number of storms in the region, as well as increased water temperatures, the spread of invasive species that are proliferate in these kind of conditions that are outcompeting the rice itself.
So now that we have that backdrop in place, let's talk about this project that you're going to be working on. Talk about where the idea came from and why this is something that you really wanted to pursue.
Yeah, so as an undergraduate, I did some research with my own tribe and a professor from my tribe, and we were able to work with the community to look at the impacts of Hurricane Matthew on our sacred Lumbee River. And through that process, I realized that I really wanted to work with Native communities to look at issues that were important to Native peoples in the context of environmental science. So when I came here, I learned about wild rice, some of the challenges with it, and it seemed like a perfect fit. So through working as a student assistant with Wisconsin Sea Grant, working on their Manoman Education and Outreach Toolkit project, I was able to see how they made connections throughout the state in ways that were equitable, and ways that were appropriate, and approached the tribes and individuals that were interested in the their project and had the time and resources to work with us. So through that, I was able to build that skill set, and then I went out and made some partners throughout the state where we could look at some of the conditions that they thought were impacting their wild rice in their local area.
And talk about what kind of research you'll actually be doing, the testing that you're already doing, and what you've got coming up in the future.
Yeah, so the project I'm particularly working at right now, I'm actually growing some Manoman. I apologize for going between rice and
all
Manoman. I'm actually growing it in buckets with the sediment and surface water from Aliquash Lake, and it's in northern Wisconsin. And when I have the buckets, I have several that are controlled, so I won't change any of the conditions with the rice that I've planted. And then the other half of them, I've actually changed the overlying water conditions to be consistent with waters that are impacted by sulfide mining in the region. So I'm looking at the difference between how the rice survives and propagates in normal conditions and in conditions that are impacted by sulfide mining.
And so how much time needs to go by before you'll actually have concrete data from that?
Yeah, and I think that, and that's kind of, it's a little complicated with getting the data, publishing it, and then, you know, in the future, we'll have to work with tribes to decide how we'll actually be disseminating that data. It might come that we work out an agreement where just the tribes have that data themselves, and then they're allowed to work from there. For if it does go forward that we can release it to the public, it'll probably be about 1 to 2 years before we have results that we are able to publish and share with the public.
We're talking right now with Sarah Dance. She is a PhD student studying environmental chemistry and technology in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. And Sarah, part of this project for you was bringing together the resources of the state's tribes and then bringing together the resources of the universities here in Wisconsin. Talk about why forging that partnership is an important part of all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, tribes and tribal people are incredibly capable to look at these water quality and sediment quality issues that are impacting rice. The part that I saw that a connection could be made was allowing the tribes to use the wealth of resources that we have at the university to investigate the things that were important to them. Because ultimately, even if rice is incredibly important to the tribes, it actually plays a role in the culture of the state and all of the peoples here. And as it's such an important ecological resource, I feel like it's very important that we have this multi-level effort to investigate the impacts with many different kinds of resources, many different diverse perspectives, and that includes from the tribes and research professors and graduate students.
And you mentioned graduate students. You're going to be working with other students on this research going forward, and it sounded like a big important aspect for you was getting other Native American students involved. Can you talk about how you're doing that?
Yeah, so there's actually only less than 5 Native American students in the engineering department in the graduate school that I know of, at least. So we have very poor representation in STEM, and that's actually even worse at this university. So that has been a challenge to find students, other Native students in the university that this is important to. So a large part of my work is creating a space and funding opportunities for other students, Native students, to come in and do this research if it's important to them and something that they would like to pursue.
Yeah, as part of this, you know, you want to show Native American students, prospective engineering students, that, hey, there's actually like a real application here, and, you know, trying to get more people just coming into these programs. Is that part of the overall goal then?
Yeah, absolutely. And that's touching on the cultural relevancy of the work. It's in environmental science, we study, as scientists, we make decisions about the kind of things that we study. We make value judgments. And Native people have a different set of values often than, you know, white scientists or majority represented scientists. And we often don't see opportunities within environmental science or environmental engineering to pursue looking at the resources or dynamics of the environment that are important to us and our culture.
So going back to your project, give us a little bit more information about the timeline. It sounds like this is going to go for a couple of growing seasons. How long will this entire project take?
So right now the project has a timeline of 2 to 2.5 to 3 years. Hopefully we can get it going. It goes well enough that it can move forward. We can find more funding in the future. We can work with more people. And then hopefully we can actually hand off the series of experiments and the resources to the tribes themselves if they decide that that was something they want to keep in-house.
Sure. And is that a way of measuring success of the project if this can keep going long after your involvement might be done with it?
Yes, that would be that would be the ideal goal, that even if that ends with the tribes having those resources and continuing this research with in whatever capacity they feel is appropriate with the university, or and having a series of graduate students, undergraduate students, professors that are interested in the work and want to continue it.
And are you hoping there's room for future collaboration between the university and the tribes? And if so, where do you hope that collaboration might happen?
Yeah, so I really do hope that there's collaboration in the future, but I would definitely push for it to be equitable. There have been collaborations in the past between this university and then the University of Minnesota with the Minnesota tribes that research and collaborations have not been equitable, and that has left a lot of negative tensions, a lot of negative impacts on the native peoples. So moving forward, I do want to see collaborations, but I want to see people basing them in respectful, equitable research practices.
So, Sarah, if people want more information about the work that you're doing, where can they go to find more information?
So this isn't necessarily about the work I'm doing, but it is about Monomin itself. And it's a resource made by Native people for other Native people and the general public. And it's called theways.org, theways.org. And that's a really important resource, so you can hear from the people themselves that are impacted by this problem how important this resource is to them.
Well, Sarah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Dance is a second-year PhD student who studies environmental chemistry and technology in the College of Engineering at UW-Madison. She spoke with Ideas Network producer Chris Molina about her project to protect and restore Wisconsin's wild rice. Coming up, we'll talk about the issue of copycat killings and how the media can work to prevent them. This in the wake of the 4 people killed in Chippewa Falls last month in a crime that some think could have been inspired by the kidnapping of Jamie Kloss. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday after 6:15 on the morning show, Wisconsin's Public Service Commission has approved new solar projects that could significantly increase the amount of power generated that way. Kate Archer-Kent looks at how homeowners and small businesses could participate in the state of solar power in Wisconsin. That's coming up Monday at 6:15 here on the Ideas Network. First, after 4 people were killed in Chippewa Falls last month, as well as the perpetrator who took his own life, the Chippewa County Sheriff suggested the perpetrator may have been trying to imitate the kidnapping of Jamie Kloss and the murder of her parents in 2018. The phenomenon is often called copycat killing, and research has shown that when certain acts of violence get intense media coverage, they can inspire others to commit similar acts. There's a growing push from experts like our next guest for media outlets to rethink their coverage of incidents like mass shootings. Pete Blair is a professor of criminal justice and the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University. He also helps run the Don't Name Them campaign, which advocates for the media to rethink their reporting on incidents like mass shootings. Pete, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
What is it about coverage of acts of mass violence that can inspire other people to commit similar acts?
Well, the major thing we see in a lot of these cases is that the attackers have a desire for notoriety or fame. And when they get wall-to-wall coverage of their life, their personality, their history, their manifesto gets published, that serves to encourage them to engage in that activity in the future.
Tell us what researchers call the contagion effect.
So the contagion effect is the idea that when there is large media coverage that happens, or a large amount of it that happens, people see that coverage and it encourages them to commit similar acts.
And how do we know that media coverage is part of what drives perpetrators of mass violence?
Well, probably the biggest study that's been done on that is by Sherry Towers out of Arizona State University, and she looked at contagion effect as it relates to mass shootings and found that the more publicity coverage there was of a large event, the more likely it was that there'd be another event that would follow in about a couple week period after that.
And the phrase copycat killings is often used, but you say that copycat isn't really the right term to describe these crimes. What's a better way to talk about them?
Yeah, when we're talking about mass shootings, what we see is the shooters are studying the ones who came before them to look for ways to improve the amount of damage, the number of people that are injured in their attacks. So going all the way back to what we would call the modern era of active shooter events, that would be 1999 with the Columbine High School shooting. You'll still see shooters today referring back to that case and those people as kind of role models for them and what they're trying to do. But then they'll go through and look at more recent cases looking for what people did that increased the number of casualties that occurred. And even in some of the dark web areas and the online chats that happen, they will critique attacks and say, well, if they had done this, they could have hurt more people.
I hate to say it, but it almost sounds like they're using previous media reporting as almost a how-to manual.
That's exactly what you see.
And I was struck by how much Columbine stands out in all of this. As you said, 20 years ago, a lot of the shooters who might follow in those footsteps were either not even born or were not of an age where they were even probably seeing it as it happened. Why is that so large in the landscape of these mass killings?
Well, as I said, we use that incident as to mark what we would call the beginning of the modern era of active shooter events. There were events before that, like the Texas Tower shooting and other events that had occurred. But that one was the first one that really got wall-to-wall media coverage. There was a lot of coverage. It hit at the right time to go on to primetime media. And there was a lot that went on as far as talking about the attackers and who they were and life histories and that sort of thing. And so I think it kind of set the model for how the events were covered from there forward. And so we see it referred back to by the attackers and by researchers.
The Columbine perpetrators, as well as many other perpetrators of these mass shooting events, they themselves die at the event, whether at their own hand or at the hand of law enforcement. Does that either make them even larger in that pantheon, or does that diminish at all the desire of people to follow in their footsteps?
Well, there absolutely can be a martyrdom type effect, and that seems to be the case in some circumstances. But what we've seen now is at least the suicide rate on scene has started to go down in more recent events. And so people are trying to survive because they see things like Aurora and the court trial that shooter gets. And that encourages them to say, well, this is a way to get my story out there even more and to stay in the limelight longer.
So staying alive is a way to even further aggrandize their image of themselves.
Exactly.
We're talking with Pete Blair right now. He's a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University, also the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center there, and he helps run the Don't Name Them campaign. We're talking about what role the media can play in discouraging people from imitating mass shootings and other tragedies. And this idea of not providing encouragement or excess publicity to events like this, and limiting that contagion effect. This is not the first time or the first topic where this has come out. There's also been a lot of talk of contagion effect with suicide. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, that happened some time ago. Researchers started to look at what appeared to be after where there would be a widely public suicide of a well-known figure, that they'd see an increase in suicide rates for a period of time after that. And the researchers started to look and try to document that, and they were able to document it in several different instances where there was somebody who either had a very widely publicized suicide or a very well-known public figure committed suicide, and then you'd see that spike in the suicide rates. And the media looked at those and said, you know, maybe we ought to change how we cover suicides now so that we're not feeding into that phenomena.
And what have those changes looked like?
Well, it's basically just shifting the coverage away from trying to give the details and the nitty-gritty about it and making it kind of just a piece that said this suicide happened and not dwell on it and move forward.
I want to talk about some of the lessons perhaps that the media, we in the media, can take from that, those guidelines for suicide. So one of the things that has been suggested strongly, and obviously your group puts it right in the name, not naming the perpetrators, not focusing on the perpetrators. What is the hope if we do not name the person who has committed that atrocity?
So this is Crime Prevention 101, and if you think back to in the 80s when we had a lot of convenience store robberies that were happening because there was a lot of cash at a convenience store because of alcohol, cigarette, and gasoline sales, they became very highly targeted locations for robbery. And there was a concerted effort made to look at how can we change what's happening at convenience stores to reduce how often robberies happen there. And there are actually many people being killed during those robberies. And one of the things they came up with, in addition to several other things, was the invention of the drop safe. So now you'll see that all over the country when the cash register will have a sign on it that says when the cash register only has $50, that means that as they pull in more money, they're putting it in a little tube and they're dropping it in the safe, and the safe isn't accessible. And the idea behind that is this concept of reducing rewards. If you reduce the amount that somebody gets or the reward that they get for committing a crime, you reduce the frequency with which the crime happens. And we've seen convenience store robberies drop a lot in more recent years. The idea here is similar, is that if we know one of the things that motivates attackers is a desire for notoriety or fame, if we can reduce the amount of notoriety or fame they get for that, then we should see a decrease in the amount of attacks that happen as well. So that's the basic concept.
And I would say one caveat to that that I've seen in the literature is that this is if either the perpetrator was killed on the scene or is in custody. Obviously, if they are looking for the perpetrator and it's known who that person is, publicizing the name in order for help to catch that person is important.
Absolutely. If it's a public safety issue, you absolutely want to get that name out there and the likeness so that people know who it is and have a chance to help catch them.
We've touched on this a bit, but I'd like to talk a little more about it because I think often, you know, in the media, the emphasis is on giving as much information and details as we are able to. But what we're talking about is that sometimes those details are not necessarily helping the public in any way other than maybe, you know, kind of a perverse fascination with these events. Some of the details are the methods that are used in the attacks, what kind of guns were used, the tactical clothing that were worn. Are there ways to responsibly cover this and both be providing the audience service that we need to, but also keeping these cautions in mind?
Sure. What we would recommend is we know the name is going to get out there. So at some point it's going to come out. What we're recommending is not focusing on that attacker and giving that notoriety or fame that they're looking for. So instead it's appropriate to focus on the heroes where they're there, the community and what the community can do to protect themselves, as well as the signs that we see that oftentimes occur before one of these events happens. And then specific actions during an event, if you should find yourself in that event, you can take to protect yourself. So there are things like that that can be talked about. The specifics of the case, really there's not as much variation as people think. There's a pretty well understood process that we typically see with these attackers. And so while it can be interesting to see what happened with this particular person, it's generally not very different from previous events that we've seen.
We're talking to Pete Blair right now. He's a criminal justice professor at Texas State University. He's also the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center there. We're talking about how the media can change its coverage of events like mass shootings to reduce the chances that their coverage will inspire other similar acts of violence. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of how the media covers mass shootings or other acts of violence? Do you want to see the media focus less on the perpetrator and more on the victims and survivors of the attacks? Or do you think that's important information to know that you want to see included in the coverage? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a moment here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're picking up our conversation with Pete Blair. He's the executive director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center and a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University. He's with us today to talk about the role the media plays in times of mass violence and the effect its coverage can have on others who may be thinking about committing similar acts. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think the media gets right when it's covering these events, and what does it get wrong? Do you think there's a way to minimize the coverage of perpetrators while balancing the public's right to know? And what questions do you have for our guest about the role media coverage plays in mass violence? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phones, and Dennis in Two Rivers is up. Hi, Dennis.
Hi, I've got a comment and a question. First, the comment is we need to be careful about privacy of the victims, because whether it's Jamie Kloss or somebody else, they want to be able to get past this. And if somebody keeps bringing this up, it's hard for them to really get through it and get over it, I think. Plus, I just wonder, is this somewhat like the old West gunslinger or a gunfighter type thing, where they're just trying to come up with some kind of reputation, even if they die doing it?
That's a good question, Dennis. Thank you. And Pete?
I think the comment about the victims is right on. You have to be very sensitive to what they want and what will help them. And for some families, that's going to be they don't want to be in the spotlight at all or talk about it at all publicly. For others, it seems to be very cathartic. So I think it's an individual basis for the victims. As far as the idea of reputation, yeah, we live in a culture that is worried about fame, and it's no longer that important about how you get that fame. What matters is that you have it. So if you think back to Paris Hilton and various people like that who are famous for being famous without good cause, that seems to be the modern culture. And this is one way of acquiring that fame.
One of the issues is that it isn't just the act that this perpetrator commits. It is also manifestos and social media postings, even sometimes videos that these perpetrators have created. How should materials like that be treated?
I wouldn't publish them widely at all. These are materials that if they hadn't committed this horrific act would never be out there. You would never see them. You would never hear about them, even if they were online. But they do this horrific act, and now all of a sudden they're thrust into the spotlight and everybody sees them, everybody reads them, everybody comments on them.
Tell us a little more about the Don't Name Them campaign and what your team is trying to do.
Well, what we've talked about here is essentially the Don't Name Them campaign. We're not very formal in what we do, but whenever we can talk to media and try to increase people's sensitivity to that, we do that. So we talk to media outlets. We also talk to law enforcement executives around the country and public information officers so that they're aware of this. We just want to put it on people's radar so that they think through it. They have an opportunity before they're thrust into a crisis situation to come up with what they think the best approach would be. And then, you know, our alert center itself also will help support media outlets by giving them B-roll and putting people on to talk about the events when they occur without focusing on the attacker to help out that way.
And I wanted to talk about the role of law enforcement, actually, because you are the executive director of Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center. I'm assuming that a lot of the people that you deal with through that work are people who would be either at the center of events like this or at the very least involved. How do you counsel them in the ways that they provide information to the public and to the media?
A lot of it in the same way that we talk about it here is making them aware of this idea that people want notoriety or fame and we should try to avoid that. We talk to them about shifting away to what people can do to protect themselves, about addressing the immediate crisis, making sure people know if there's any ongoing risk or not, that's been concluded, but really focusing away from the actual attacker themselves. Sheriff Hanlon was probably a big example of that, and while we didn't train him or coach him to do that, we thought his approach was a strong approach to say, look, I'm not going to name this guy publicly. The information will get out to you. We're not trying to suppress it, but we're not going to make this person an instant media sensation by putting their name out there at the outset of this investigation.
I want to listen to New Zealand's Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern. Here she is talking after the attacks in Christchurch, New Zealand this past March.
He sought many things from his act of terror, but one was notoriety. And that is why you will never hear me mention his name. He is a terrorist. He is a criminal. He is an extremist. But he will, when I speak, be nameless.
I remember when she made those comments, it was a very powerful statement. Is this an idea, a concept that is getting a lot of traction?
Well, it varies off and on. We have had some media outlets and some big name personalities say that they won't be talking about the names of the attackers or putting them in the forefront. Other places have been more resistant to that. And that's part of our ongoing education campaign, to continue that conversation and that talk and make sure people are aware of the issues and encourage them to do what we think would be the right decision.
We're talking with Pete Blair. He's a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University, and we're talking about responsible media coverage of mass shootings. And let's go to the phone, and Matt in Stanley is up. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, I guess a very interesting topic. I agree wholeheartedly with it, and parts of me kind of don't agree with it. Just kind of thinking back to probably one of the more recent, at least school shootings down in Florida, where 20-some individuals lost their lives. There was a gentleman in there, well, not so much of a gentleman, that went into that school and committed 20-some capital murders. Now, I don't know what his name is, and probably neither one of you do, because that's not what the media concentrated on. And the problem is if you take the perpetrator who commits capital murder out of it, well, then who are you? Who and what are you going to blame?
Thank you for that call, Matt. And actually, Pete, that brings up an interesting thing. What would fill the void if we do pull back on that kind of information?
Well, again, there are other sorts of information that are more useful. So if you look at the pattern that led to this attacker's attack, and I know who the attacker was.
I guessed you might.
and you can find it if you look for it. We see a very common pattern here that there were warning signs that happened beforehand. This wasn't just a spur of the moment thing where this person got angry and launched this attack, and there were things that could be detected. So talking about that pattern, that downward spiral that people often enter before these events, is helpful so that people understand what the warning signs are, as well as then making sure that they report those warning signs to authorities, which was done in this case, but unfortunately he was low priority on the radar at the time.
And Pete, what kind of changes do you hope to see having gotten put into place in, say, 5 years from now?
I would love to see, when the coverage happens, that the coverage immediately shifts away from the attacker, instead focusing on the communities, the victims where it's appropriate, the heroes, what people can do to protect themselves, what the pattern is that leads to this. And then I would hope that would also be tied in with a decrease in how many of these events happen.
And do you have ideas for where people in the media or any people can learn more about this issue and educate themselves on why this might be an important approach to take?
Sure. We have our Don't Name Them website. It's don'tnamethem.org. And then you can always contact the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University. That's alert2rs.org. And we'll be happy to take any queries you have and direct you anything we can to help out.
Well, Pete, thank you so much for spending the time with us. It's an important topic, and we were grateful for your time.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Pete Blair, a professor of criminal justice at Texas State University and part of the Don't Name Them campaign. He's also the director of the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center. We spoke with him about the issue of copycat or imitative crimes, mass shootings, and other acts of violence in the wake of a shooting in Chippewa Falls recently. Coming up Monday on Central Time, with the presidential election more than 15 months away, we're already in the midst of active campaigning and messaging. We'll ask why election campaigns in the U.S. are so long and whether that helps or hurts our democracy. And we'll talk with an investigative reporter about a college scam. Coming up Monday on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Monday after 7:30, businesses that sell firearms in Wisconsin would be required to lock up all of the weapons at closing time under a Democratic proposal before the state legislature. WPR State Capitol reporter Laurel White joins Kate Archer-Kent to share details of the plan and other news in the State Capitol report. That's Monday at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR, and then we celebrate the art of the popsicle during this week's edition of Food Friday. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Thanks for joining us on Central Time.